The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Well, good evening. I am not Vina Jones Cox, but I'm your host, Scott Ellsworth. Sitting in for Vina tonight. We have a great guest with us. He is going to be speaking at the National Real Estate Summit that is coming up October 31st through November 3rd in Cincinnati. That's a national summit. There's going to be over 30 workshops. They're going to everything from finding deals to getting financing, alternative exit strategies, assets, asset protection, tax savings, you name it. One of the things we're doing, too, is there's a special package available to any Real Life Real Estate listener who pledges $179 to WMKV, okay? And you not only get a seat at a live event for that $197, you get a free VIP upgrade, which is a lot of extras, and we've even thrown in a free course about how to negotiate comfortably and effectively with sellers, because that sometimes can make people a little bit nervous, or a little bit those who hate public speaking, hate talking to people. It will really help. So it's over $500 worth of real estate and education for just $197. So we encourage you to definitely support WMKV and pledge with that. We've only made 30 of those available, so 12 of them have already been taken. So I would go to WMKVFM.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click in the link before they're all gone. So I think it would be great. I've been to the event. The event is awesome. I would have wish I would have gone to it earlier in my career, but it's never too late to start. So tonight, one of the presenters at the summit is my good friend John Heyer. John, how you doing?
Can't complain in sunny Puerto Rico and picking up some ultraviolet and saving taxes.
All right, you gotta like that, and you save taxes living down there, but that's for another discussion. So we're gonna talk entities, the appropriate entities for real estate business. So first, I'm gonna throw out there. Oh, let me just say, if you have any questions, we really encourage you to call in. Number's 877-772-9658. 877-772-9658. If you have questions. So John, when somebody's first getting into real estate, you know, when do they need to get that first entity? Do they do it right away? What's an entity for? Why do we need an entity?
Well, we give the lawyer answer. It depends. There are two reasons for entities: asset protection and sometimes tax savings. Now, in real estate, oftentimes entities are tax neutral. And we don't want to make things worse, which people sometimes do by putting things like rental properties into S corporations or C corporations. Tax-wise, that's a mistake. I would say the first thing is do a deal. I mean, the prerequisite of asset protection would be assets. Right. Now, there are newbies. For example, let's say you have a medical practice and you get into real estate. You're new to real estate, but you're not newbie. You have something to lose. All right, then you might want to get on the entity before you do that first deal. But I would say do a deal. Just go do a deal. Take the time, invest in learning, education, how to do it, marketing, how to find the deals, the income, the assets. Do a deal. Unless it's a huge deal, not doing it in an entity isn't going to make that much difference. So take it slower. There are going to be a lot of people selling to you, especially out of Nevada and Utah. They're very good at fear. They're very good at marketing. They're not always very good lawyers or very honest about it. So I would say take it slow, take it easy. If you do use an entity from day one, LLC with no S corporation election, no C corporation election, because I can undo LLCs if there's any sort of mistake. I cannot always undo a corporation or an LLC taxed as a corporation. Too long-winded or about right?
No, that is very good. So when you see people who create entities, let's talk about some of the, you know, maybe what's probably the biggest mistake you've seen with investors and entity structures?
Templates, and especially never changing them. I get it that when you first start, maybe you don't have as much to lose, which kind of goes back to what I was saying before. A well-done entity takes some time or money or both, because the operating agreement in particular is very important. That's especially true if you're not the only human being involved. And so template operating agreements that punt problems. The idea is ahead of time to talk about not just happy things, such as how do we split the profit? That's a happy conversation because there's a profit. But also talk about the unhappy things. Well, what if there's a loss? And then the person putting in the money and goes, whoa, what do you mean loss? Well, hey, that's not the plan. And here are the things we're doing to avoid that. But we have to have that discussion now while we're friendly. And if that's a discussion that doesn't go well when you're friendly, it's really not going to go well when you're unfriendly. So discussing details, expectations, exactly who does what. And again, a lot of these template operating agreements don't have any of that in there. It's something you think through and you draft. Now, why do people avoid it? It takes time and it costs money if you're using a lawyer, which most of the time you really should. But you can save some money and time, or I should say some of the lawyer's time and your money, by talking ahead of time through the checklist of how do we want to handle various events, various issues. Very clearly, who is going to do what? If you negotiate, discuss, agree, make a nice bullet-pointed list. It doesn't have to be grammatical or beautiful, but you make that nice checklist, it makes the lawyer's job easier. If you're doing deals with someone else, you have an operating agreement, you didn't use a lawyer, you're not a lawyer, you're asking for trouble if things go badly, which the whole point of entities is, if things go badly, they're supposed to make things less bad.
Right, exactly. Tell you what, we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk to John Hire more. He's a tax attorney. He is the expert in this field. And we will be back shortly, and we'll talk to him more. All right, welcome back. We're here with John Hire, Esquire. He's a tax attorney, and he's a CPA. So he's got it all. He took all the tests, which is a lot, and he does a great job. So John, you all may know, I'm a CPA as well. John, one of the things that I get is, you know, the idea of, we talked about the operating agreements, helping to make the partnership go well and hopefully dissolve well and do a lot better than if you had nothing. But what about the asset protection? I have occasionally clients will come and say, hey, I want to protect my assets. So I'm going to be buying 10 properties. I'm going to put 10 of them in separate LLCs. How do you respond to that?
It's TMI from the internet. The problem with the internet is TMI, and you don't know what to believe without good guidance. That's very frequently put out on the internet. It makes sense if each property has net equity of $1 million. You buy large commercial buildings or mobile home parks or whatnot, then you really probably do want one LLC for each, you have enough assets to protect that it justifies that number of LLCs, and you probably have the resources to properly maintain those LLCs. For beginners, it is normally lunacy to put one property per LLC, absolute lunacy, the opposite of what the internet says. And here's why. One, if you try and convert a limited liability company into a no liability company, hey, all you can do is take this one property because I got 10 LLCs and each one has a property. And if there's a lawsuit, it sticks in that one LLC, which is the theory, not always the reality. And I'm also going to make sure there's just not much to take. I'm going to put a large loan on the property and there's just not much equity. You're shooting for a no liability company. That quite understandably and correctly upsets judges. They will pierce based on artificially low capitalization. You got to leave some skin in the game. You got to leave a bone for the dog to take. If you try and strip these LLCs out, it's not going to typically go well in front of a judge. Second, like children, LLCs are fun and easy to make and take a lot of maintenance once you've got one. And a lot of investors who are very good at deals are not good at annual maintenance. And there are things that need to be done that are frequently missed, that once a judge is upset, it gives them an excuse to poke holes in it. So I think the structure for newbies, one property, especially just single family homes, some of them with very little equity, per LLC, actually backfires and provides less asset protection.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I have seen real estate investors, bless their heart, they're great at doing deals, but the details just aren't there. And for them, what are some of the things you need to have to do to maintain those LLCs properly?
They each need to have a bank account. Let me repeat that, because again, it's the opposite of what the internet says. And I can show case law where the internet and the lawyers who are trying to market a million LLCs are just plain wrong. An LLC is a financial person. If a legal bullet is fired, you want that paper person, that financial person, to eat the bullet instead of you personally. How can you be a financial person without a bank account? Oh, I have a management company that pays everything on behalf of the LLC. I've seen those management companies, first of all, and most entrepreneurs do a terrible job with them. It makes things harder. It creates more transactions to mess up, and they usually do get messed up. So I want to see annual meetings with notes, which is not hard to do. Get your cronies together, talk about what you normally talk about, record it with their permission, have AI or a VA or both convert it to notes, customize it for each company. Good QuickBooks or the equivalent, an income statement and balance sheet per property and per entity, and a leather bound, could be fake leather. I mean, let's not get extravagant on spending, but sort of this document folder that it creates gravitas, that makes it seem serious. We're creating an impression with someone we've never met, a judge. We want to have our operating agreements, our formation agreements, our EIN letter, et cetera, all in there. We want it to look and feel and actually be a legitimate business separate from its owner. And that's the key, separate from its owner. So those are a few pointers right there. I could, and in fact, at OREA, shall go on.
Good. Let's talk about that. So you're going to be at OREA. What are some of the things you're going to speak on at OREA?
You know, it'll be a mix. It's an eclectic crowd. We are going to get into some of the asset protection like we're discussing now. We're going to get into tax savings. As you know, I'm a massive fan of tax-free accounts. What Romney and what Peter Thiel, for example, did with their, in Romney's case, Seth, and in Thiel's case, Roth IRA, I think is worthy of imitation, and it does have a place in real estate. But also the tax savings built into real estate, particularly with rentals, and how to alleviate the tax problems that other kinds of real estate cause. For example, flipping and assigning, selling, whether for cash or on payments, create tax issues. Unlike rentals, which are very tax favored, those categories tend to create tax liability, and we have to find ways to offset it. So that's a sprinkling of what I'll be discussing. You know, there are limits to what we can do in the 90 minutes, but we'll make it well worth people's while.
Good. You mentioned accounting. So this is about entities, but I think it's a valid, important topic. So I've had a lot of folks who just sort of do stuff on the almost the back of the napkin, just gather stuff up at tax time. What problems does that cause when you have to, again, you're trying to have an entity that gives you limited liability protection? What problems does that cause? And then what's the proper way to do it?
Let's start with that last piece. I like to see QuickBooks or the equivalent. I want every property to have its own income statement and balance sheet. I want no expenses paid in cash, none. You need to be able to prove to the IRS that you paid. And proving that you paid something in cash usually means calling the person whom you paid as a witness, which doesn't always go well, assuming they even show up. You do need, and people aren't going to like this, but they need to know it. It really removes the fear factor if they do it. So all expenses paid through a bank statement of some sort, whether it's credit card or checking, All of that needs to be in QuickBooks or the equivalent, and it all needs to tie together. Second, one needs an invoice or receipt for every single transaction. Let me repeat that. One needs an invoice or receipt for every single transaction. I have had audits where when the IRS examiner gets upset, they're increasingly prone to getting upset. I don't like the new ones very much. When they get upset, they have a nuclear weapon. Give me all the bank statements and all the receipts, both, not either or. Oh, I have a credit card statement. That proves what I need to prove. You need the statement and the receipt. And they say, I want it for every transaction for the last 3 years for every entity. That's a nightmare. Unless what? You have it already, and you just can say, here it is.
So they've got to have a file system, and they need to have an accounting system. And a lot of people don't do it. They don't want to pay the money. Investors are very, we'll say, a lot of investors are frugal, and rightly so, right? They're just starting out. They're trying to build their portfolio. They need to save money. I want them to make money before they spend money. But there are some things that they need to bite the bullet and bear the cost, because it's going to save them a lot of headaches in the future.
If I may, I will add with the accounting, I'd rather see them, for all that I'm the guy that sells entities, I'd rather see you put money into the accounting system first. The accounting system has two other key functions. It tells you how much you're making or losing. A lot of investors use their bank account as a proxy. That's not a good idea. I'm surprised at the number of people who lose money and don't realize they're losing money because the bank account has money in it. Second, for asset protection, exactly the same books and records I described are crucial to distinguishing between entities or between entities and yourself personally. No good books, no asset protection.
Yeah, that is just, it's crazy, but they are, they do that. So we do recommend you have a good accounting system. Again, it doesn't have to be QuickBooks. It can be something else, but it needs to be something that is going to give you that income statement, and balance sheet. So one of the questions people always ask is, you know, and you slightly mentioned it before, they'll say, I need to do this in the state of Wyoming or this state of Nevada or Delaware. What is a good state? We're gonna have a little bit of time just to talk about that. We'll come back to it too, and then we have a caller with a question. But is it real or is it made up?
It's a mix of both, right? Most large lies have a grain of truth. Those are the best lies, even if it's not always an intentional lie. It's just a misstatement. So it used to be that the U.S. had a much more formalistic legal system. And if you formed an entity in Wyoming, say, what were called the internal affairs of the entity between, for example, the shareholders, the owners, perhaps sometimes outside litigants, was governed by Wyoming law. But increasingly the trend has been, if you do business here, you are subject to our law. For example, you have a rental property in Ohio. I would have the LLC that owns the rental property be in Ohio. Setting one up in Wyoming or Nevada will add expense. It is enormously, and I mean enormously, unlikely to add value. In other words, Wyoming law is extraordinarily unlikely to apply. One of the exceptions would be is if you have a holding company. Let's say you have, I don't know, 100 properties and let's just say 5 LLCs. I'm making numbers up here. I wouldn't read too much into them. You have 100 properties and 5 LLCs. The LLCs are set up in the states where the properties are actually at because that's the law that is almost certainly going to apply. And then you have a holding company, which is legit. You might put the holding company in Wyoming. And why? Because there's a greater than 0% chance that if they make it through one of the lower level companies, that is they pierce the veil, the lower level company fails, and they go to the next level, if you have a holding company, that may save your rear. And holding company law often is in the state where the entity is formed and not in the state where the underlying issue occurred. So there are cases where it makes sense, but they are very much the exception to the rule.
Okay. Good information. So we are going to take a break, and then when we come back, we got a listener with a question. Thanks. All right, welcome back. I'm your host, Scott Ellsworth. I'm here with John Heyer, probably the best attorney, tax attorney, especially with real estate in the nation. Just a note, if you need to call in with questions, and I do have a caller that we're going to talk to in a minute, 877-772-9658. I did want to make one announcement. Tonight, there's a creative deal structuring help night. So there's no lecture. It's just five very experienced creative person, creative finance practitioners. Vina, who isn't here right now, but she'll be on that call. She'll be on that Zoom. Pete Fortunato and Bill Cook, all of them are great at creative financing. They're going to be online to help you in structuring your creative deals, answer questions you might have. It could be subject twos, private loans, owner financing, options, wraps, mortgages, whatever it would be. So go to CincinnatiRIA.com, CincinnatiRIA.com to register. And we are now back with John, and we're going to go to Alan. Alan, you've got a question. Alan?
Yes, I do. Hey there, John, Scott. Good to talk to you. This is Alan from Ohio.
Glad you're on.
Yeah, I have a question. So if you are, one thing you don't think about is when you're closing down an entity. So if you have a LLC that sold a property, was the only property in it, you should be closing down that LLC. Is there anything that should be considered when doing that?
Yes. Hesitate. Think a minute. Are there any other possible liabilities? There is this idea out there that if you open and close an entity periodically, I've seen people open and close entities every 5 years on the theory that once they close the entity, all liability dies with that entity. It is the opposite. If you close an entity while it still has liability, you may have just transferred the liability to yourself. So the first thing is to make sure there are no further debts, whether obvious debts or what lawyers would call contingent debts. In other words, is there a possibility of a lawsuit or the like, or worse yet, an actual lawsuit? So you want to be really thorough in making sure the entity is truly done and has completed all of its obligations. Now, if that's the case, then you draft up the appropriate articles. You may have some meeting minutes to say the company's closing. You pay all the debts. You close the company, and you file articles of dissolution with the state. The entity is then closed. But just be sure before you close it, nothing is left hanging.
Okay. Right. That's very good advice. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Alan. So right now I've got an email question from Elaine from Georgia, and she asks, when I first got into real estate 3 years ago, my CPA recommended a C-Corp, which I got. I just heard John say that he didn't recommend C-Corps and that they're hard to undo. Why? Is there something better I should do? I invest in single-family homes, and my C Corp, my goodness, owns three of them.
All right. To start with, you typically will talk to both a tax advisor and a lawyer when deciding on entities. Now, in my case, I'm not a CPA, but I am an accountant, but I do tax law and asset protection law, so I wear both hats. A lot of the time, you won't find those two people in one person, so you need to talk to both because they're going to have different perspectives on it. It sounds like the C corporation may be holding rentals. A C corporation can make sense if you're into flipping. You generate normal income. You buy and sell things. It's inventory, what we call in tax world ordinary income. And if you're in a very high bracket, sometimes for a variety of reasons, C corps make sense. I can talk and have talked for 2 hours on that subject, but that is the exception to the rule. To put rental properties into a C corp is 99.9% of the time, not just wrong, horribly wrong. You lose the tax benefits of the rentals. You increase the tax rate to the extent that they show a profit after depreciation, expenses, etc. I have seen law journal articles state that putting rental property or being advised to put rental properties into a C corporation is malpractice. I tend to agree with it. It's a strong statement. I hope that's not your situation. Here's the problem. If you have appreciating property, whether it's rentals or Bitcoin or notes in a C corporation or even in an S corporation, oftentimes we cannot fix the problem. We simply stop doing that. And for example, if you intend to acquire more rentals, stop putting them inside the C corporation. So that's a synopsis, a very complex subject, and I'm generalizing in a very large fashion. So I don't know your details. Maybe your CPA was dead right for reasons I just don't know.
Yeah, John, I'll tell you, I have a client who he has every one. I mean, millions and millions of dollars of rentals, and they're all in an S corp. So one of the things that has happened to him is he wants to get the cash out. So he goes and he borrows. He gets a loan on it. The S corp does, and then he, after he gets the money in the bank, he takes that as a distribution.
No.
So maybe you can talk. I have talked to him, but maybe you can talk to the audience about that's another big problem with having real estate in an S corp. So can you address that?
And let's differentiate. If you're flipping, if you're buying and selling, an S corp often makes a lot of sense. In fact, if you're buying and selling in volume, it tends to be the default choice because it reduces self-employment tax.
Totally agree.
But for real estate holding in an S corporation, S corporations have very different rules than LLCs. And by the way, that would include LLCs taxed as S corporations. As far as the IRS is concerned, an S corporation or an LLC taxed as an S corporation, those are the same thing. They don't see any difference between them. Now, for state law, for asset protection purposes, they're a little bit different. But S corporations have the problem. Okay, for the geeks, outside basis rules are different. For normies, how do we translate that into English? The rules that decide how much money you can take out of the company and how many losses you can use are much, much more restrictive with S corporations than with regular LLCs if rentals are involved. And that's especially true if you're borrowing from not you, meaning borrowing from a bank, which is pretty typical. So yeah, that's unfortunate when we see clients with rentals and S-corps. I've also seen it very frequently. And it's just the default rule is rentals go in LLCs unless there's a good written reason and you understand why those rentals are being put into a corporation. And by the way, it's probably 2 out of 1,000 times that somebody puts rentals into an S corp or a C corp on purpose, and it was a good reason. I have seen it happen by accident where you intended to flip a property. It wasn't an S corp. The property never sold and it just gets rented and you're just kind of stuck with it, but at least it happened by accident and not on purpose.
Right. So we have a caller, Rick. You have a question. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, John. The lender for a single-family home requires a single-purpose entity and will not allow multiple properties in the LLC. Is that a legitimate reason or defense for me as far as piercing the veil or a judge that blows out the LLC?
Yes. In other words, it's very common practice in the industry. If you're lending, you want to do this. If you're lending, I mean, your lender is smart. They want what's called a bankruptcy remote entity, meaning if the entity declares bankruptcy, all it owns is that rental property. There are no other creditors. Easy peasy. They get the property. Bankruptcy slows them down a little and not much else. So makes a lot of sense from the lender standpoint. And that helps you because now you have a reason for one property per entity, and you did not create that reason. You were not trying to create a no liability company instead of a limited liability company. Rather, outside forces that are customary went ahead and said, here's why we need one property per LLC. That is much more likely to withstand scrutiny from a judge because you didn't make it that way. An outside force, and for that matter, an outside force that follows market customs was behind it. And judges will swallow that a lot better.
But again, I will say that, as John said before, if you're doing that, remember, you've got to maintain every LLC properly. So just remember
that. Got it. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. We have another an email question from Jackson in Dayton, Ohio. I've heard that single-member LLCs are no longer good because they don't provide asset protection, and that we should all make family members or close friends 10% owners Is that true or just more internet rumor?
A little bit of both. It's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. Many things in life involve trade-offs. It is true that single-member LLCs get less respect in general than multi-member. But a court will still look at why it's multi-member. So the Vegas people often recommend make someone a 1% owner. And what do we see when that happens? A, for the same reason the court doesn't respect a single-member entity, they ignore a trivial, nominal member. Second, a lot of the times the member isn't really a member. They're a member on paper, but they didn't put any money in. They don't get any money out. There's no reality to their membership. Now, 10% is a real number. If someone is truly a 10% member, but assuming they did something for that 10%, they did something, they put in money, they put in time, it was realistic, it's a trade-off. Now, in the event of a lawsuit, you have a little bit better protection in front of a judge because they do have a greater respect for multi-member, true multi-member, not fake, but true multi-member entities. But what's the trade-off? You got yourself a 10% partner, and that's a today for real trade-off. So we traded, I have a partner today with rights and who can cause problems today and extra expenses for filing partnership returns and the like versus something that may never happen. In fact, most asset protection with LLCs is what I call low probability, high consequence. Very unlikely to be necessary, very necessary if you in fact need it. That's a tough trade-off. And personally, most of the time, I fall on the spectrum of keep it single member. I understand it's weaker than multi-member, but the hassle of creating a true multi-member is probably not worth the benefit and the brain damage. Now, there are exceptions. For example, when you have a very large property, let's say people own skyscrapers in downtown Los Angeles. That's not such a great example. Those used to be worth a lot more than they are now, but you know what I mean. They will make sure there is a legitimate, usually at least 5% second member, usually a children's trust, because those people have so much money that, trust me, their kids have trusts and real trusts, not just little dinky trusts. So size matters. The larger the property, the value we're dealing with, the more likely I am to recommend a true, honest-to-God, multi-member entity.
All right. So I want to mention one other thing we're having coming up. Saturday, there's an online workshop. It's called How to Use the Financial Calculator to Structure Better Deals. It's a hands-on workshop. It runs 9 to 1, so it's just 4 hours. You can get out and enjoy the rest of the day. You'll learn how to use that HP 10 BII calculator to you'll work through actual real estate problems. And it's going to come with a 25-page manual. It really is invaluable. You really need to have this information to know how to use a financial calculator. It can make all the world of difference in structuring creative deals, knowing what you're having to put out, things like that. So register for that. It's coming up this Saturday at CincinnatiRIA.com. We're going to take a break, come back, talk to John a little bit about trusts. All right, welcome back. I'm your host, Scott Ellsworth, here with John Heyer, real estate attorney who definitely knows his stuff. We're going to talk a little bit about trusts, but I have one question from an email. It's from Tamook. It says, can you cite any case where a judge disregarded a single-member LLC solely, underlined, because it was a single-member LLC?
No, they're always a lot more nuanced than that. That's not what they would do. It plays into factors. Judges look at a situation and think, especially because this is sort of an equity issue, there's law and equity, an old distinction made by old-fashioned lawyers, less in the modern sense. But what does it mean? They look at all the factors. Now, will they seize on that it's single member or that you didn't make maintenance very well? Yeah, they'll use that to get to the decision they want to get to. What do they ultimately look at? They will look at the state statute. Fewer of them are doing that than I would like. And they will look at how fair they feel the situation is. But there is a clear record of single-member LLCs and small entrepreneur LLCs being pierced at a much greater rate than larger, quote-unquote, established or big entities. No question about it.
All right. Thanks for that question, John. Great answer. So I want to talk a little bit about trust. Two issues with trust. One is there is the question of, are trusts asset protection. The other one is really, there's been a wave of companies doing it. I've seen it. I know Vina has, where they're offering various trusts that supposedly avoid income taxes. So the question is, can you really have trust that allow you to run a business, keep profits, and not pay any tax? So really those questions, do they really provide asset protection? And can you really, with what kind of trust, and can you really avoid income taxes?
Let's start with the easy question. Can you use a trust other than an IRA or a 401k, which are technically trusts, to avoid income tax? No. There's a ton of these being promoted, and the names mutate faster than COVID, right? Common law trusts, constitutional trusts, pure trusts, my irrevocable grantor whatever trust. I think the most recent iteration I've seen of it is the exact same trust, except now a charity is the owner of the trust on paper. But who owns it for real? Because that's what the courts look at, and especially what the tax court looks at. Who owns the trust for real? Well, let's see. The charity that owns it on paper never gets any money. Any property the trust owns is used by the taxpayer. I wonder who the true beneficiary really is. Who could it be? So these trusts are widely marketed. There is a telltale. There are, for me, a number of telltales. I've researched these very deeply because I had so many clients involved in them, some of whom really should have known better, some pretty high net worth people that really wanted to believe things that were too good to be true. And so I had to prove it to them. And I did. One of the things to look for, the first telltale for me, if you find someone saying that extraordinary dividends are not taxable, extraordinary dividends are a return of corpus or an increase in corpus, if you hear that or see that written, you immediately know you're dealing with fraud. Just done. Over. That is, for the experts on the call, a state fiduciary issue of how you account for trust income based on what the trustee has to do. It has nothing to do with taxation. Nothing to do with taxation. What these people do is they introduce it as if it were a tax issue. It's not. If you see that language, every single advertisement or document that I've seen with that language, that extraordinary dividends are part of corpus and not taxable, or a return of corpus and not taxable, have been flat out blatant fraud. And I do not say that lightly. Now, trusts are great magnifiers in both directions. They're very complicated. Trusts are much more complex than LLCs or corporations. And that's saying something, because if you look at the volumes of ink spilled over corporations and LLCs, it is highly non-trivial. These are not necessarily simple things. Trusts are not only more complex, fewer lawyers understand them, and the rules vary from state to state much more than they do with entities. So you're dealing with more complexity with trusts. And there are 100 different kinds of trusts, most of them legitimate. Most of them are legit. Do they provide asset protection? If you gave away the property, it's an irrevocable trust. You have a trustee, almost always not you or even someone very close to you, and they have control and you don't, meaning the grant of property to the trust was irrevocable. You don't own the property anymore. Probably that trust provides a degree of asset protection. If, however, you have control, you're the trustee, you can get rid of the trustee, boss them around, whatever, probably no asset protection. Classic example, living trusts, which are a legitimate tool for certain things. What's a living trust? It's designed to avoid probate. It makes distributing assets once you die much, much faster and easier in some jurisdictions. That is legitimate. Does it provide any asset protection? No. No, because it's a revocable trust. You can undo it. You have control. Oftentimes, you're the trustee. Now, this is a super basic gloss of a super complex subject. So hopefully I've started to do it justice.
Yeah, it is very complex. Thank you. So what's your take? So we have the Corporate Transparency Act. We're just going to touch on it. I want to sort of save it towards closer to the end, because I don't want to get too wrapped up in it. But what is your take on the whole Corporate Transparency Act and FinCEN? What are you telling clients to do with this onerous law?
It is Orwellian. It is un-American. However, it is. It is law. I don't like it, but the penalties for not complying are horrific, intentionally so. It is designed to terrorize you into following the law. If you do not report entities that should be reported under the Corporate Transparency Act, and here's the real sneaky catch, when there are changes, for example, your driver's license that you submitted to FinCEN when you first report your entity expires, and you fail to report the new driver's license, or you move and you fail to report your address, those are all reportable transactions. If you don't report those in time, usually it's 30 days, could be 90 days, but bottom line, if you don't report those changes in time, you have penalties of up to $500 a day, $10,000 per count, plus just maybe you're a felon and it's 2 years prison time. So I do unfortunately have to tell people, comply. In fact, this is not a law where you want to get clever and play the gray, right? When the penalty for being wrong is massive, this is not where we get creative or play games. You comply. And again, I don't agree with it, but it is the law. So if you set up an entity pre-24, you have until the end of 24 to report the entity. And I would, by the way, do that roughly in November. That should be enough time for them to work the bugs out of the system and enough time for you to get it done. But with something that has such heavy penalties, I don't think I'd procrastinate past that. Now, if you set up an entity in 24, you have 90 days to report. And I absolutely would do so. Again, I don't like it. I do think you should comply. There is, to my knowledge, one court case in a very narrow jurisdiction that says it's unconstitutional. I haven't seen the appeal of that yet. So far, I haven't seen any other case law. In other words, this idea that there was a district court ruling, a federal district court ruling that says it's unconstitutional, probably doesn't apply to you. And we'll see if it applies to the people that are currently covered by it once it's appealed.
So there are companies out there who, because I now get them in my mail all the time, that say, hey, we'll do this for you. Had any experience with them? Anything?
Here's my sense, because I have this. I've thought about doing it, and I don't. Here's why. From the standpoint of a lawyer, I have huge liability for getting it wrong, particularly if you have a complex structure with a lot of entities and trusts involved. I have to read every agreement, every page in detail. If I'm wrong, I have huge malpractice potential. I have to ask you a lot of questions. And if I get a sense that you're playing games or being fishy, I need to back off, because I can be liable as the lawyer, which is crazy, but I can be liable and even forced to report you. And so the liability for doing that kind of reporting for me raises the price so much that most people would find it unattractive. And frankly, I would still be kind of twitchy over the liability. When you see people offering to do it, if they're really cheap, I have to question how credible they are. Most of you are capable of reporting. Most of these small to medium-sized business owners I know are capable of answering the questions that need to be answered off the top of their head, assuming they sit and think about it and are honest. And you want to err on the side of being conservative. In other words, you want to over-report, right? You have to report who owns 25% or more directly or indirectly. Indirectly can get really interesting. Convertible debt, options, those all count as ownership. You also have to report whoever has certain amounts of control. That might be your spouse, even though your spouse is not in the operating agreement, because the spouse shows up at the job site and bosses people around. Is that control, even though it's not written down somewhere? Yeah. So I would answer conservatively, meaning over-disclose. Most of you are capable of doing it correctly, as long as you don't try too hard to be clever.
Well, and I'll tell you, I have attorneys, and even we, I mean, as a CPA, we have this maybe not as significant a fiduciary responsibility as you do, but they're basically saying, we're not doing this. Most of CPA firms have sent out letters to their clients saying, we don't do this. And then I've heard of attorneys who were saying, we're now not going to set up LLCs.
Because if you set up an LLC, you have to report. And the liability for misreporting is so high, plus it may force you to turn on your client, which is sort of an a rare thing. I mean, lawyers and clients have a special relationship. Our communications are mostly protected. This is a huge, huge dent, to put it politely, in that relationship, and is not the norm for Anglo-Saxon law. So it really undermines the relationship to be put in that position. A lot of lawyers are avoiding being put in that position. I'm one of them.
Makes sense. Well, John, listen, you have been a wealth of information tonight. Appreciate your all the advice you've given on entity structures. And I encourage everybody to go to the summit in this fall, October 31st. Get signed up for that. And we will see you all next week.